7. Jim stayed moody and silent for a week. As Atticus had once advised me to do, I tried to climb into Jim's skin and walk around in it. If I had gone alone to the Radley place at 2 in the morning, my funeral would have been held the next afternoon, so I left Jim alone and tried not to bother him. School started. The second grade was as bad as the first, only worse. They still flash cards at you and wouldn't let you read or write. Miss Caroline's progress next door could be estimated by the frequency of laughter. However, the usual crew had flunked the first grade again and were helpful in keeping order. The only thing good about the second grade was that this year I had to stay as late as Jim, and we usually walked home together at 3 o'clock. One afternoon when we were crossing the schoolyard toward home, Jim suddenly said, "There's something I didn't tell you." As this was his first complete sentence in several days, I encouraged him. "About what?" "About that night." "You've never told me anything about that night," I said. Jim waved my words away as if fanning gnats. He was silent for a while. Then he said, "When I went back for my breeches, they were all in a tangle when I was getting out of them. I couldn't get them loose. When I went back," Jim took a deep breath, "when I went back, they were folded across the fence, like they were expecting me." "Across and something else." Jim's voice was flat. "Show you when we get home. They've been sewed up. Not like a lady sewed them. Like something I'd try to do. All crooked. It's almost like somebody knew you were coming back for them." Jim shuddered. "Like somebody was reading my mind. Like somebody could tell what I was going to do. Can anybody tell what I'm going to do lest they know me? Can they, Scout?" Jim's question was an appeal. I reassured him. "Can't anybody tell what you're going to do lest they live in the house with you? And even I can't tell sometimes." We were walking past our tree. In its knothole rested a ball of gray twine. "Don't take it, Jim," I said. "This is somebody's hiding place." "I don't think so, Scout." "Yes, it is. Somebody like Walter Cunningham comes down here every recess and hides his things, and we come along and take them away from him. Listen, let's leave it and wait a couple of days. If it ain't gone then, we'll take it, okay?" "Okay, you might be right," said Jim. "It must be some little kid's place. Hides his things from the bigger folks. You know, it's only when school's in that we've found things." "Yeah," I said, "but we never go by here in the summertime." We went home. Next morning, the twine was where we had left it. When it was still there on the third day, Jim pocketed it. From then on, we considered everything we found in the knothole our property. The second grade was grim, but Jim assured me that the older I got, the better school would be, that he started off the same way, and it was not until one reached the sixth grade that one learned anything of value. The sixth grade seemed to please him from the beginning. He went through a brief Egyptian period that baffled me. He tried to walk flat a great deal, sticking one arm in front of him and one in back of him, putting one foot behind the other. He declared Egyptians walked that way. I said if they did, I didn't see how they got anything done, but Jim said they accomplished more than the Americans ever did. They invented toilet paper and perpetual embalming and asked where would we be today if they hadn't. Atticus told me to delete the adjectives and I'd have the facts. There are no clearly defined seasons in South Alabama. Summer drifts into autumn, and autumn is sometimes never followed by winter, but turns to a days-old spring that melts into summer again. That fall was a long one, hardly cool enough for a light jacket. Jim and I were trotting in our orbit one mild October afternoon when our knothole stopped us again. Something white was inside this time. Jim let me do the honors. I pulled out two small images carved in soap. One was the figure of a boy. The other wore a crude dress. Before I remembered that there was no such thing as hoodooing, I shrieked and threw them down. Jim snatched them up. "What's the matter with you?" he yelled. He rubbed the figures free of red dust. "These are good," he said. "I've never seen any of these good." He held them down to me. They were almost perfect miniatures of two children. The boy had on shorts, and a shock of soapy hair fell to his eyebrows. I looked up at Jim. A point of straight brown hair kicked downwards from his part. I had never noticed it before. Jim looked from the girl doll to me. The girl doll wore bangs. So did I. "These are us," he said. "Who did 'em, you reckon? Who do we know around here who whittles?" he asked. "Mr. Avery. Mr. Avery just does like this. I mean carves." Mr. Avery averaged a stick of stove wood per week. He honed it down to a toothpick and chewed it. "There's old Miss Stephanie Crawford's sweetheart," I said. "He carves all right, but he lives down the country. When would he ever pay any attention to us? Maybe he sits on the porch and looks at us instead of Miss Stephanie. If I was him, I would." Jim stared at me so long I asked what was the matter, but got nothing, Scout, for an answer. When we went home, Jim put the dolls in his trunk. Less than 2 weeks later, we found a whole package of chewing gum, which we enjoyed. The fact that everything on the Radley place was poison having slipped Jim's memory. The following week, the knot hole yielded a tarnished medal. Jim showed it to Atticus, who said it was the spelling medal, that before we were born, the Macomb County schools had spelling contests and awarded medals to the winners. Atticus said someone must have lost it, and had we asked around? Jim camel-kicked me when I tried to say where we had found it. Jim asked Atticus if he remembered anybody who ever won one, and Atticus said no. Our biggest prize appeared 4 days later. It was a pocket watch that wouldn't run on a chain with an aluminum knife. "You reckon it's white gold, Jim?" "Don't know. I'll show it to Atticus." Atticus said it would probably be worth $10, knife, chain, and all, if it were new. "Did you swap with somebody at school?" he asked. "Oh, no, sir." Jim pulled out his grandfather's watch that Atticus let him carry once a week if Jim were careful with it. On the days he carried the watch, Jim walked on eggs. "Atticus, if it's all right with you, I'd rather have this one instead. Maybe I can fix it." When the new wore off his grandfather's watch and carrying it became a day's burdensome task, Jim no longer felt the necessity of ascertaining the hour every 5 minutes. He did a fair job, only one spring and two tiny pieces left over, but the watch would not run. "Oh," he sighed, "it'll never go. Scout, huh? You reckon we ought to write a letter to whoever's leaving us these things? That'd be right nice, Jim. We can thank 'em." "What's wrong?" Jim was holding his ears, shaking his head from side to side. "I don't get it. I just don't get it. I don't know why, Scout." He looked toward the living room. "I've got a good mind to tell Atticus." "No, I reckon not." "I'll tell him for you." "No, don't do that, Scout.
Scat?
What? He had been on the verge of telling me something all evening. His face would brighten, and he would lean toward me. Then he would change his mind. He changed it again. Oh, nothing. Here, let's write a letter. I pushed a tablet and pencil under his nose. Okay. Dear Mr. How do you know it's a man? I bet it's Miss Maudie. Been betting that for a long time. Ah, Miss Maudie can't chew gum. Jim broke into a grin. You know, she can talk pretty sometimes. One time I asked her to have a chew and she said no thanks. That chewing gum cleaved to her palate and rendered her speechless, said Jim carefully. Doesn't that sound nice? Yeah, she can say nice things sometimes. She wouldn't have a watch and chain anyway. Dear sir, said Jim, we appreciate everything which you have put into the tree for us. Yours very truly, Jeremy Atticus Finch. He won't know who you are if you sign it like that, Jim. Jim erased his name and wrote, Jim Finch. I signed, Jean Louise Finch, Scout, beneath it. Jim put the note in an envelope. Next morning, on the way to school, he ran ahead of me and stopped at the tree. Jim was facing me when he looked up, and I saw him go stark white. Scout! I ran to him. Someone had filled our knothole with cement. Don't you cry now, Scout. Don't cry now. Don't you worry, he muttered at me all the way to school. When we went home for dinner, Jim bolted his food, ran to the porch, and stood on the steps. I followed him. Hasn't passed by yet, he said. Next day, Jim repeated his vigil and was rewarded. Howdy do, Mr. Nathan, he said. Morning, Jim, Scout, said Mr. Radley as he went by. Mr. Radley, said Jim. Mr. Radley turned around. Mr. Radley, did you put cement in that hole in that tree down yonder? Yes, he said. I filled it up. Why'd you do it, sir? Trees dying. You plug 'em with cement when they're sick. You ought to know that, Jim. Jim said nothing more about it until late afternoon. When we passed our tree, he gave it a meditative pat on its cement and remained deep in thought. He seemed to be working himself into a bad humor, so I kept my distance. As usual, we met Atticus coming home from work that evening. When we were at our steps, Jim said, Atticus, look down yonder at that tree, please, sir. What tree, son? The one on the corner of the Radley lot coming from school? Yes. Is that tree dying? Why, no, son. I don't think so. Look at the leaves. They're all green and full. No brown patches anywhere. It ain't even sick. That tree's as healthy as you are, Jim. Why? Mr. Nathan Radley said it was dying. Well, maybe it is. I'm sure Mr. Radley knows more about his trees than we do. Atticus left us on the porch. Jim leaned on a pillar, rubbing his shoulders against it. Do you itch, Jim? I asked as politely as I could. He did not answer. Come on in, Jim, I said. After a while. He stood there until nightfall, and I waited for him. When we went in the house, I saw he had been crying. His face was dirty in the right places, but I thought it odd that I had not heard him. Eight. For reasons unfathomable to the most experienced prophets in Macomb County, autumn turned to winter that year. We had 2 weeks of the coldest weather since 1885, Attica said. Mr. Avery said it was written on the Rosetta Stone that when children disobeyed their parents, smoked cigarettes, and made war on each other, the seasons would change. Jim and I were burdened with the guilt of contributing to the aberrations of nature, thereby causing unhappiness to our neighbors and discomfort to ourselves. Old Mrs. Radley died that winter, but her death caused hardly a ripple. The neighborhood seldom saw her except when she watered her cannas. Jim and I decided that Boo had got her at last, but when Atticus returned from the Radley house, he said she died of natural causes, to our disappointment. "Ask him," Jim whispered. "You ask him. You're the oldest. That's why you ought to ask him." "Atticus," I said, "did you see Mr. Arthur?" Atticus looked sternly around his newspaper at me. "I did not." Jim restrained me from further questions. He said Atticus was still touchy about us and the Radleys, and it wouldn't do to push him any. Jim had a notion that Atticus thought our activities that night last summer were not solely confined to strip poker. Jim had no firm basis for his idea. He said it was merely a twitch. Next morning I awoke, looked out the window, and nearly died of fright. My screams brought Atticus from his bathroom half-shaven. "The world's ending, Atticus! Please do something!" I dragged him to the window and pointed. "No, it's not," he said. "It's snowing." Jim asked Atticus, would it keep up? Jim had never seen snow either, but he knew what it was. Atticus said he didn't know any more about snow than Jim did. "I think, though, if it's watery like that, it'll turn to rain." The telephone rang, and Atticus left the breakfast table to answer it. "That was Eula May," he said when he returned. I quote, "As it has not snowed in Macomb County since 1885, there will be no school today." Eula May was Macomb's leading telephone operator. She was entrusted with issuing public announcements, wedding invitations, setting off the fire siren, and giving first aid instructions when Dr. Reynolds was away. When Atticus finally called us to order and bade us look at our plates instead of out the windows, Jim asked, "How do you make a snowman?" "I haven't the slightest idea," said Atticus. "I don't want you all to be disappointed, but I doubt if there'll be enough snow for a snowball even." Calpurnia came in and said she thought it was sticking. When we ran to the backyard, it was covered with a feeble layer of soggy snow. "We shouldn't walk about in it," said Jim. "Look, every step you take's wasting it." I looked back at my mushy footprints. Jim said if we waited until it snowed some more, we could scrape it all up for a snowman. I stuck out my tongue and caught a fat flake. It burned. "Jim, it's hot." "No, it ain't. It's so cold it burns. Now don't eat it, Scout. You're wasting it. Let it come down." "But I want to walk in it." "I know what. We can go walk over at Miss Maudie's." Jim hopped across the front yard. I followed in his tracks. When we were on the sidewalk in front of Miss Maudie's, Mr. Avery accosted us. He had a pink face and a big stomach below his belt. "See what you've done," he said. "Hasn't snowed in Macomb since Appomattox. It's bad children like you makes the seasons change." I wondered if Mr. Avery knew how hopefully we had watched last summer for him to repeat his performance, and reflected that if this was our reward, there was something to say for sin. I did not wonder where Mr. Avery gathered his meteorological statistics. They came straight from the Rosetta Stone. "Jim Finch! You, Jim Finch!" "Miss Maudie's calling you, Jim." "You all stay in the middle of the yard. There's some thrift buried under the snow near the porch. Don't step on it." "Yes'm," called Jim. "It's beautiful, ain't it, Miss Maudie? Beautiful my hind foot. If it freezes tonight, it'll carry off all my azaleas." Miss Maudie's old sun hat glistened with snow crystals. She was bending over some small bushes, wrapping them in burlap bags. Jim asked her what she was doing that for. "Keep 'em warm," she said. "How can flowers keep warm? They don't circulate." "I cannot answer that question, Jim Finch. All I know is if it freezes tonight, these plants will freeze, so you cover 'em up. Is that clear?"
"Yes'm. Miss Maudie?"
"What, sir?" "Could Scout and me borrow some of your snow?"
"Heavens alive, take it all. There's an old peach basket under the house. Haul it off in that."
Miss Maudie's eyes narrowed. "Jim Finch, what are you going to do with my snow?"
"You'll see," said Jim, and we transferred as much snow as we could from Miss Maudie's yard to ours, a slushy operation.
"What are we going to do, Jim?" I asked.
"You'll see," he said. "Now get the basket and haul all the snow you can rake up from the backyard to the front. Walk back in your tracks, though," he cautioned.
"Are we going to have a snow baby, Jim?"
"No, a real snowman. Gotta work hard now."
Jim ran to the backyard, produced the garden hoe, and began digging quickly behind the woodpile, placing any worms he found to one side. He went in the house, returned with the laundry hamper, filled it with earth, and carried it to the front yard. When we had 5 baskets of earth and 2 baskets of snow, Jim said we were ready to begin.
"Don't you think this is kind of a mess?" I asked.
"Looks messy now, but it won't later," he said. Jim scooped up an armful of dirt, patted it into a mound on which he added another load and another until he had constructed a torso.
"Jim, I ain't ever heard of a nigger snowman," I said.
"He won't be black long," he grunted. Jim procured some peach tree switches from the backyard, platted them, and bent them into bones to be covered with dirt.
"He looks like Miss Stephanie Crawford with her hands on her hips," I said, "fat in the middle and little bitty arms."
"I'll make 'em bigger." Jim sloshed water over the mud man and added more dirt. He looked thoughtfully at it for a moment. Then he molded a big stomach below the figure's waistline. Jim glanced at me, his eyes twinkling.
"Mr. Avery's sort of shaped like a snowman, ain't he?"
Jim scooped up some snow and began plastering it on. He permitted me to cover only the back, saving the public parts for himself. Gradually, Mr. Avery turned white. Using bits of wood for eyes, nose, mouth, and buttons, Jim succeeded in making Mr. Avery look cross. A stick of stove wood completed the picture. Jim stepped back and viewed his creation.
"It's lovely, Jim," I said. "Looks almost like he'd talk to you."
"It is, ain't it?" he said shyly. We could not wait for Atticus to come home for dinner, but called and said we had a big surprise for him. He seemed surprised when he saw most of the backyard and the front yard, but he said we had done a Jim-dandy job.
"I didn't know how you were going to do it," he said to Jim, "but from now on, I'll never worry about what'll become of you, son. You'll always have an idea."
Jim's ears reddened from Atticus's compliment, but he looked up sharply when he saw Atticus stepping back. Atticus squinted at the snowman a while. He grinned, then laughed.
"Son, I can't tell what you're going to be, an engineer, a lawyer, or a portrait painter. You've perpetrated a near libel here in the front yard. We've got to disguise this fellow."
Atticus suggested that Jim hone down his creation's front a little, swap a broom for the stove wood, and put an apron on him. Jim explained that if he did, the snowman would become muddy and cease to be a snowman.
"I don't care what you do, so long as you do something," said Atticus. You can't go around making caricatures of the neighbors. Ain't a caricature, said Jim. It looks just like him. Mr. Avery might not think so.
I know what, said Jim. He raced across the street, disappeared into Miss Maudie's backyard, and returned triumphant. He stuck her sun hat on the snowman's head and jammed her hedge clippers into the crook of his arm. Attica said that would be fine. Miss Maudie opened her front door and came out on the porch. She looked across the street at us. Suddenly she grinned. Jim Finch, she called. You devil, bring me back my hat, sir. Jim looked up at Atticus, who shook his head. She's just fussing, he said. She's really impressed with your accomplishments. Atticus strolled over to Miss Maudie's sidewalk, where they engaged in an arm-waving conversation. The only phrase of which I caught was, erected an absolute morphidite in that yard. Atticus, you'll never raise 'em. The snow stopped in the afternoon. The temperature dropped, and by nightfall, Mr. Avery's direst predictions came true. Calpurnia kept every fireplace in the house blazing, but we were cold. When Atticus came home that evening, he said we were in for it, and asked Calpurnia if she wanted to stay with us for the night. Calpurnia glanced up at the high ceilings and long windows and said she thought she'd be warmer at her house. Atticus drove her home in the car. Before I went to sleep, Atticus put more coal on the fire in my room. He said the thermometer registered 16, that it was the coldest night in his memory, and that our snowman outside was frozen solid. Minutes later, it seemed, I was awakened by someone shaking me. Atticus's overcoat was spread across me. Is it morning already? Baby, get up. Atticus was holding out my bathrobe and coat. Put your robe on first, he said. Jim was standing beside Atticus, groggy and tousled. He was holding his overcoat closed at the neck. His other hand was jammed into his pocket. He looked strangely overweight. Hurry, hon, said Atticus. Here are your shoes and socks. Stupidly, I put them on. Is it morning? No, it's a little after one. Hurry now. That something was wrong finally got through to me. What's the matter? By then, he did not have to tell me. Just as the birds know where to go when it rains, I knew when there was trouble in our street. Soft, taffeta-like sounds and muffled, scurrying sounds filled me with helpless dread. Whose is it? Miss Maudie's, hun, said Atticus gently. At the front door, we saw fire spewing from Miss Maudie's dining room windows. As if to confirm what we saw, the town fire siren wailed up the scale to a treble pitch and remained there, screaming. It's gone, ain't it? Moaned Jim. I expect so, said Atticus. Now listen, both of you. Go down and stand in front of the Radley place. Keep out of the way, do you hear? See which way the wind's blowing? Oh, said Jim. Atticus, reckon we ought to start moving the furniture out?
Not yet, son. Do as I tell you. Run now. Take care of Scout, you hear? Don't let her out of your sight.
With a push, Atticus started us toward the Radley front gate. We stood watching the street fill with men and cars while fire silently devoured Miss Maudie's house. Why don't they hurry? Why don't they hurry? Muttered Jim. We saw why. The old fire truck, killed by the cold, was being pushed from town by a crowd of men. When the men attached its hose to a hydrant, the hose burst and water shot up, tinkling down on the pavement. Oh, Lord, Jim. Jim put his arm around me. Hush, Scout,
he said. It ain't time to worry yet. I'll let you know when. The men of Macomb, in all degrees of dress and undress, took furniture from Miss Maudie's house to a yard across the street. I saw Atticus carrying Miss Maudie's heavy oak rocking chair and thought it sensible of him to save what she valued most. Sometimes we heard shouts. Then Mr. Avery's face appeared in an upstairs window. He pushed a mattress out the window into the street and threw down furniture until men shouted, "Come down from there, Dick! The stairs are going! Get out of there, Mr. Avery!" Mr. Avery began climbing through the window. "Scout, he's stuck," breathed Jim. "Oh, God!" Mr. Avery was wedged tightly. I buried my head under Jim's arm and didn't look again until Jim cried, "He's got loose, Scout! He's all right!" I looked up to see Mr. Avery cross the upstairs porch. He swung his legs over the railing and was sliding down a pillar when he slipped. He fell, yelled, and hit Miss Maudie's shrubbery. Suddenly I noticed that the men were backing away from Miss Maudie's house, moving down the street toward us. They were no longer carrying furniture. The fire was well into the second floor and had eaten its way to the roof. Window frames were black against a vivid orange center. "Jim, it looks like a pumpkin. Scout, look!" Smoke was rolling off our house and Miss Rachel's house like fog off a riverbank, and men were pulling hoses toward them. Behind us, the fire truck from Abbotsville screamed around the curve and stopped in front of our house. "That book," I said. "What?" said Jim. "That Tom Swift book. It ain't mine. It's Dill's." "Don't worry, Scout. It ain't time to worry yet," said Jim. He pointed. "Look yonder." In a group of neighbors, Atticus was standing with his hands in his overcoat pockets. He might have been watching a football game. Miss Maudie was beside him. "See there, he's not worried yet," said Jim. "Why ain't he on top of one of the houses?" "He's too old. He'd break his neck." "You think we ought to make him get our stuff out?" "Let's don't pester him. He'll know when it's time," said Jim. The Abbotsville fire truck began pumping water on our house. A man on the roof pointed to places that needed it most. I watched our absolute morphidite go black and crumble. Miss Maudie's sun hat settled on top of the heap. I could not see her hedge clippers. In the heat between our house, Miss Rachel's and Miss Maudie's, the men had long ago shed coats and bathrobes. They worked in pajama tops and nightshirts stuffed into their pants. But I became aware that I was slowly freezing where I stood. Jim tried to keep me warm, but his arm was not enough. I pulled free of it and clutched my shoulders. By dancing a little, I could feel my feet. Another fire truck appeared and stopped in front of Miss Stephanie Crawford's. There was no hydrant for another hose, and the men tried to soak her house with hand extinguishers. Miss Maudie's tin roof quelled the flames. Roaring, the house collapsed. Fire gushed everywhere, followed by a flurry of blankets from men on top of the adjacent houses, beating out sparks and burning chunks of wood. It was dawn before the men began to leave, first one by one, then in groups. They pushed the Macomb fire truck back to town. The Abbotsville truck departed. The third one remained. We found out next day it had come from Clark's Ferry, 60 miles away. Jim and I slid across the street. Miss Maudie was staring at the smoking black hole in her yard, and Attica shook his head to tell us she did not want to talk. He led us home, holding on to our shoulders to cross the icy street. he said Miss Maudie would stay with Miss Stephanie for the time being. "Anybody want some hot chocolate?" he asked. I shuddered when Atticus started a fire in the kitchen stove. As we drank our cocoa, I noticed Atticus looking at me, first with curiosity, then with sternness. "I thought I told you and Jim to stay put," he said. "Why, we did. We stayed. Then whose blanket is that?" "Blanket?" "Yes, ma'am, blanket. It isn't ours." I looked down and found myself clutching a brown woolen blanket I was wearing around my shoulders, squaw fashion. "Atticus, I don't know, sir. I turned to Jim for an answer, but Jim was even more bewildered than I. He said he didn't know how it got there. We did exactly as Atticus had told us. We stood down by the Radley gate away from everybody. We didn't move an inch. Jim stopped. "Mr. Nathan was at the fire," he babbled. "I saw him. I saw him. He was tugging that mattress. Atticus, I swear." "That's all right, son," Atticus grinned slowly. "Looks like all of Macon was out tonight, in one way or another. Jim, there's some wrapping paper in the pantry, I think. Go get it and we'll—" "Atticus, no, sir." Jim seemed to have lost his mind. He began pouring out our secrets right and left in total disregard for my safety, if not for his own, omitting nothing, knot hole, pants, and all. "Mr. Nathan put cement in that tree, Atticus, and he did it to stop us finding things. He's crazy, I reckon, like they say. But, Atticus, I swear to God, he ain't ever harmed us. He ain't ever hurt us. He could have cut my throat from ear to ear that night, but he tried to mend my pants instead. He ain't ever hurt us, Atticus." Atticus said, "Whoa, son," so gently that I was greatly heartened. It was obvious that he had not followed a word Jim said, for all Atticus said was, "You're right. We'd better keep this and the blanket to ourselves. Some day, maybe, Scout can thank him for covering her up." "Thank who?" I asked. "Boo Radley. You were so busy looking at the fire, you didn't know it when he put the blanket around you." My stomach turned to water, and I nearly threw up when Jim held out the blanket and crept toward me. He sneaked out of the house, turned around, sneaked up, and went like this. Atticus said dryly, "Do not let this inspire you to further glory, Jeremy." Jim scowled. I ain't going to do anything to him, but I watched the spark of fresh adventure leave his eyes. "Just think, Scout," he said. "If you'd just turned around, you'd have seen him." Calpurnia woke us at noon. Atticus had said we need not go to school that day. We'd learn nothing after no sleep. Calpurnia said for us to try and clean up the front yard. Miss Maudie's sun hat was suspended in a thin layer of ice, like a fly in amber, and we had to dig under the dirt for her hedge clippers. We found her in her backyard, gazing at her frozen, charred azaleas. "We're bringing back your things, Miss Maudie," said Jim. "We're awful sorry." Miss Maudie looked around, and the shadow of her old grin crossed her face. "Always wanted a smaller house, Jim Finch. Gives me more yard. Just think, I'll have more room for my azaleas now." "You ain't grieving, Miss Maudie?" I asked, surprised. Atticus said her house was nearly all she had. "Grieving, child? Why, I hated that old cow barn. Thought of setting fire to it 100 times myself, except they'd lock me up. But don't you worry about me, Jean Louise Finch. There are ways of doing things you don't know about. Why, I'll build me a little house and take me a couple of roomers, and gracious, I'll have the finest yard in Alabama. Those bell and grass'll look plain puny when I get started." Jim and I looked at each other.
How'd it catch, Miss Maudie? He asked.
I don't know, Jim. Probably the flu in the kitchen. I kept a fire in there last night for my potted plants. Hear you had some unexpected company last night, Miss Jean Louise.
How'd you know?
Atticus told me on his way to town this morning. Tell you the truth, I'd like to have been with you, and I'd have had sense enough to turn around, too.
Miss Maudie puzzled me. With most of her possessions gone, and her beloved yard a shambles, she still took a lively and cordial interest in Jim's and my affairs. She must have seen my perplexity. She said, "Only thing I worried about last night was all the danger and commotion it caused. This whole neighborhood could have gone up. Mr. Avery'll be in bed for a week. He's right stove up. He's too old to do things like that, and I told him so. Soon as I can get my hands clean, and when Stephanie Crawford's not looking, I'll make him a lane cake. That Stephanie's been after my recipe for 30 years, and if she thinks I'll give it to her just because I'm staying with her, she's got another think coming." I reflected that if Miss Maudie broke down and gave it to her, Miss Stephanie couldn't follow it anyway. Miss Maudie had once let me see it. Among other things, the recipe called for 1 large cup of sugar. It was a still day. The air was so cold and clear, we heard the courthouse clock clank, rattle, and strain before it struck the hour. Miss Maudie's nose was a color I had never seen before, and I inquired about it. "I've been out here since 6 o'clock," she said. "Should be frozen by now." She held up her hands. A network of tiny lines crisscrossed her palms, brown with dirt and dried blood. "You've ruined 'em," said Jim. "Why don't you get a colored man?" There was no note of sacrifice in his voice when he added, "Or Scout and me, we can help you." Miss Maudie said, "Thank you, sir, but you've got a job of your own over there." She pointed to our yard. "You mean the Morphidite?" I asked. "Shoot, we can rake him up in a jiffy." Miss Maudie stared down at me, her lips moving silently. Suddenly she put her hands to her head and whooped. When we left her, she was still chuckling. Jim said he didn't know what was the matter with her. That was just Miss Maudie.
9.
"You can just take that back, boy."
This order given by me to Cecil Jacobs was the beginning of a rather thin time for Jim and me. My fists were clenched, and I was ready to let fly. Atticus had promised me he would wear me out if he ever heard of me fighting any more. I was far too old and too big for such childish things, and the sooner I learned to hold in, the better off everybody would be. I soon forgot. Cecil Jacobs made me forget. He had announced in the schoolyard the day before that Scout Finch's daddy defended niggers. I denied it, but told Jim. "What'd he mean saying that?" I asked. "Nothing," Jim said. "Ask Atticus. He'll tell you." "Do you defend niggers, Atticus?" I asked him that evening. "Of course I do. Don't say nigger, Scout. That's common." "'S what everybody at school says." "From now on, it'll be everybody less one." "Well, if you don't want me to grow up talking that way, why do you send me to school?" My father looked at me mildly, amusement in his eyes. Despite our compromise, my campaign to avoid school had continued in one form or another since my first day's dose of it. The beginning of last September had brought on sinking spells, dizziness, and mild gastric complaints. I went so far as to pay a nickel for the privilege of rubbing my head against the head of Miss Rachel's cook's son, who was afflicted with a tremendous ringworm. It didn't take.
but I was worrying another bone. Do all lawyers defend Negroes, Atticus?
Of course they do, Scout.
Then why did Cecil say you defended niggers? He made it sound like you were running a still.
Atticus sighed. I'm simply defending a Negro. His name's Tom Robinson. He lives in that little settlement beyond the town dump. He's a member of Calpurnia's church, and Cal knows his family well. She says they're clean living folks. Scout, you aren't old enough to understand some things yet, but there's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man. It's a peculiar case. It won't come to trial until summer session. John Taylor was kind enough to give us a postponement.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons, said Atticus. The main one is, if I didn't, I couldn't hold up my head in town. I couldn't represent this county in the legislature. I couldn't even tell you or Jim not to do something again.
You mean if you didn't defend that man, Jim and me wouldn't have to mind you anymore?
That's about right.
Why?
Because I could never ask you to mind me again. Scout, simply by the nature of the work, every lawyer gets at least one case in his lifetime that affects him personally. This one's mine, I guess. You might hear some ugly talk about it at school, but do one thing for me if you will. You just hold your head high and keep those fists down. No matter what anybody says to you, don't you let 'em get your goat. Try fighting with your head for a change. It's a good one, even if it does resist learning.
Atticus, are we going to win it?
No, honey.
Then why?
Simply because we were licked 100 years before we started is no reason for us not to try to win, Atticus said.
You sound like Cousin Ike Finch, I said.
Cousin Ike Finch was Macomb County's sole surviving Confederate veteran. He wore a General Hood-type beard, of which he was inordinately vain. At least once a year, Atticus, Jim, and I called on him, and I would have to kiss him. It was horrible. Jim and I would listen respectfully to Atticus and Cousin Ike rehash the war. Tell you, Atticus, Cousin Ike would say, the Missouri Compromise was what licked us, but if I had to go through it again, I'd walk every step of the way there and every step back, just like I did before, and furthermore, we'd whip 'em this time. Now, in 1864, when Stonewall Jackson came around by, I beg your pardon, young folks, old Blue Light was in heaven then. God rest his saintly brow.
Come here, Scout, said Atticus. I crawled into his lap and tucked my head under his chin. He put his arms around me and rocked me gently. It's different this time, he said. This time we aren't fighting the Yankees. We're fighting our friends. But remember this. No matter how bitter things get, they're still our friends, and this is still our home. With this in mind, I face Cecil Jacobs in the schoolyard next day.
You gonna take that back, boy?
You gotta make me first, he yelled.
My folks said your daddy was a disgrace and that nigger ought to hang from the water tank.
I drew a bead on him, remembered what Atticus had said, then dropped my fists and walked away.
Scout's a coward, ringing in my ears. It was the first time I ever walked away from a fight. Somehow, if I fought Cecil, I would let Atticus down. Atticus so rarely asked Jim and me to do something for him. I could take being called a coward for him. I felt extremely noble for having remembered and remained noble for 3 weeks. Then Christmas came and disaster struck. Jim and I viewed Christmas with mixed feelings. The good side was the tree and Uncle Jack Finch. Every Christmas Eve day, we met Uncle Jack at Macomb Junction, and he would spend a week with us. A flip of the coin revealed the uncompromising lineaments of Aunt Alexandra and Frances. I suppose I should include Uncle Jimmy, Aunt Alexandra's husband, but as he never spoke a word to me in my life except to say, "Get off the fence," once, I never saw any reason to take notice of him. Neither did Aunt Alexandra. Long ago, in a burst of friendliness, Auntie and Uncle Jimmy produced a son named Henry, who left home as soon as was humanly possible, married, and produced Frances. Henry and his wife deposited Frances at his grandparents' every Christmas, then pursued their own pleasures. No amount of sighing could induce Atticus to let us spend Christmas Day at home. We went to Finch's Landing every Christmas in my memory. The fact that Auntie was a good cook was some compensation for being forced to spend a religious holiday with Francis Hancock. He was a year older than I, and I avoided him on principle. He enjoyed everything I disapproved of and disliked my ingenuous diversions. Aunt Alexandra was Atticus's sister, but when Jim told me about changelings and siblings, I decided that she had been swapped at birth, that my grandparents had perhaps received a Crawford instead of a Finch. Had I ever harbored the mystical notions about mountains that seemed to obsess lawyers and judges, Aunt Alexandra would have been analogous to Mount Everest. Throughout my early life, she was cold and there. When Uncle Jack jumped down from the train Christmas Eve day, we had to wait for the porter to hand him 2 long packages. Jim and I always thought it funny when Uncle Jack pecked Atticus on the cheek. They were the only 2 men we ever saw kiss each other. Uncle Jack shook hands with Jim and swung me high, but not high enough. Uncle Jack was a head shorter than Atticus, the baby of the family. He was younger than Aunt Alexandra. He and Auntie looked alike, but Uncle Jack made better use of his face. We were never wary of his sharp nose and chin. He was one of the few men of science who never terrified me, probably because he never behaved like a doctor. Whenever he performed a minor service for Jim and me, as removing a splinter from a foot, he would tell us exactly what he was going to do, give us an estimation of how much it would hurt, and explain the use of any tongs he employed. One Christmas, I lurked in corners nursing a twisted splinter in my foot, permitting no one to come near me. When Uncle Jack caught me, he kept me laughing about a preacher who hated going to church so much that every day he stood at his gate in his dressing gown, smoking a hookah and delivering 5-minute sermons to any passers-by who desired spiritual comfort. I interrupted to make Uncle Jack let me know when he would pull it out, but he held up a bloody splinter in a pair of tweezers and said he yanked it while I was laughing. That was what was known as relativity. "What's in those packages?" I asked him, pointing to the long, thin parcels the porter had given him. "None of your business," he said. Jim said, "How's Rose Almer?" Rose Almer was Uncle Jack's cat. She was a beautiful yellow female. Uncle Jack said was one of the few women he could stand permanently. He reached into his coat pocket and brought out some snapshots. We admired them. "She's getting fat," I said. "I should think so. She eats all the leftover fingers and ears from the hospital." "Oh, that's a damn story," I said. "I beg your pardon," Atticus said. Don't pay any attention to her, Jack. She's trying you out. Cal says she's been cussing fluently for a week now.
Uncle Jack raised his eyebrows and said nothing. I was proceeding on the dim theory, aside from the innate attractiveness of such words, that if Atticus discovered I had picked them up at school, he wouldn't make me go. But at supper that evening, when I asked him to pass me the damn ham, please, Uncle Jack pointed at me. "See me afterwards, young lady," he said. When supper was over, Uncle Jack went to the living room and sat down. He slapped his thighs for me to come sit on his lap. I liked to smell him. He was like a bottle of alcohol and something pleasantly sweet. He pushed back my bangs and looked at me. "You're more like Atticus than your mother," he said. "You're also growing out of your pants a little. I reckon they fit all right. You like words like damn and hell now, don't you?" I said, "I reckon so." "Well, I don't," said Uncle Jack. "Not unless there's extreme provocation connected with them. I'll be here a week, and I don't want to hear any words like that while I'm here. Scout, you'll get in trouble if you go around saying things like that. You want to grow up to be a lady, don't you?" I said, "Not particularly." "Of course you do. Now let's get to the tree." We decorated the tree until bedtime, and that night I dreamed of the two long packages for Jim and me. Next morning, Jim and I dived for them. They were from Atticus, who had written Uncle Jack to get them for us, and they were what we had asked for. "Don't point them in the house," said Atticus when Jim aimed at a picture on the wall. "You'll have to teach him to shoot," said Uncle Jack. "That's your job," said Atticus. I merely bowed to the inevitable. It took Atticus's courtroom voice to drag us away from the tree. He declined to let us take our air rifles to the landing. I had already begun to think of shooting Francis, and said if we made one false move, he'd take them away from us for good. Finch's Landing consisted of 366 steps down a high bluff and ending in a jetty. Farther downstream, beyond the bluff, were traces of an old cotton landing where Finch Negroes had loaded bales and produce, unloaded blocks of ice, flour and sugar, farm equipment and feminine apparel. A two-rut road ran from the riverside and vanished among dark trees. At the end of the road was a two-storied white house with porches circling it upstairs and downstairs. In his old age, our ancestor, Simon Finch, had built it to please his nagging wife. But with the porches, all resemblance to ordinary houses of its era ended. The internal arrangements of the Finch house were indicative of Simon's guilelessness and the absolute trust with which he regarded his offspring. There were 6 bedrooms upstairs, 4 for the 8 female children, 1 for Welcome Finch, the sole son, and 1 for visiting relatives. Simple enough, but the daughters' rooms could be reached only by 1 staircase, Welcome's room and the guest room only by another. The daughter's staircase was in the ground floor bedroom of their parents, so Simon always knew the hours of his daughter's nocturnal comings and goings. There was a kitchen separate from the rest of the house, tacked onto it by a wooden catwalk. In the backyard was a rusty bell on a pole, used to summon field hands or as a distress signal. A widow's walk was on the roof, but no widow's walk there. From it, Simon oversaw his overseer, watched the river boats, and gazed into the lives of surrounding landholders. There went with the house the usual legend about the Yankees. 1 Finch female, recently engaged, donned her complete trousseau to save it from raiders in the neighborhood.
She became stuck in the door to the daughter's staircase, but was doused with water and finally pushed through. When we arrived at the landing, Aunt Alexandra kissed Uncle Jack. Francis kissed Uncle Jack. Uncle Jimmy shook hands silently with Uncle Jack. Jim and I gave our presents to Francis, who gave us a present. Jim felt his age and gravitated to the adults, leaving me to entertain our cousin. Francis was 8 and slicked back his hair. "What'd you get for Christmas?" I asked politely. "Just what I asked for," he said. Francis had requested a pair of knee pants, a red leather book sack, 5 shirts, and an untied bow tie.
"That's nice," I lied. "Jim and I got air rifles, and Jim got a chemistry set. A toy one, I reckon."
"No, a real one. He's going to make me some invisible ink, and I'm going to write to Dill in it."
Francis asked what was the use of that.
"Well, can't you just see his face when he gets a letter from me with nothing in it? It'll drive him nuts."
Talking to Francis gave me the sensation of settling slowly to the bottom of the ocean. He was the most boring child I ever met. As he lived in Mobile, he could not inform on me to school authorities, but he managed to tell everything he knew to Aunt Alexandra, who in turn unburdened herself to Atticus, who either forgot it or gave me hell, whichever struck his fancy. But the only time I ever heard Atticus speak sharply to anyone was when I once heard him say, "Sister, I do the best I can with them." It had something to do with my going around in overalls. Aunt Alexandra was fanatical on the subject of my attire. I could not possibly hope to be a lady if I wore breeches. When I said I could do nothing in a dress, she said I wasn't supposed to be doing things that required pants. Aunt Alexandra's vision of my deportment involved playing with small stoves, tea sets, and wearing the add-a-pearl necklace she gave me when I was born. Furthermore, I should be a ray of sunshine in my father's lonely life. I suggested that one could be a ray of sunshine in pants just as well, but Auntie said that one had to behave like a sunbeam, that I was born good but had grown progressively worse every year. She hurt my feelings and set my teeth permanently on edge, but when I asked Atticus about it, he said there were already enough sunbeams in the family and to go on about my business. He didn't mind me much the way I was. At Christmas dinner, I sat at the little table in the dining room. Jim and Francis sat with the adults at the dining table. Auntie had continued to isolate me long after Jim and Francis graduated to the big table. I often wondered what she thought I'd do, get up and throw something. I sometimes thought of asking her if she would let me sit at the big table with the rest of them just once, I would prove to her how civilized I could be. After all, I ate at home every day with no major mishaps. When I begged Atticus to use his influence, he said he had none. We were guests, and we sat where she told us to sit. He also said Aunt Alexandra didn't understand girls much. She'd never had one. But her cooking made up for everything. 3 kinds of meat, summer vegetables from her pantry shelves, peach pickles, 2 kinds of cake, and ambrosia constituted a modest Christmas dinner. Afterwards, the adults made for the living room and sat around in a dazed condition. Jim lay on the floor, and I went to the backyard. "Put on your coat," said Atticus dreamily, so I didn't hear him. Francis sat beside me on the back steps. "That was the best yet," I said. "Grandma's a wonderful cook," said Francis. "She's going to teach me how." "Boys don't cook." I giggled at the thought of Jim in an apron. "Grandma says all men should learn to cook. The men ought to be careful with their wives and wait on them when they don't feel good," said my cousin. "I don't want Dill waiting on me," I said. "I'd rather wait on him." "Dill?" "Yeah. Don't say anything about it yet, but we're going to get married as soon as we're big enough. He asked me last summer." Francis hooted.
"What's the matter with him?" I asked. "Ain't anything the matter with him. You mean that little runt Grandma says stays with Miss Rachel every summer?" "That's exactly who I mean." "I know all about him," said Frances. "What about him?"
"Grandma says he hasn't got a home."
"Has to. He lives in Meridian.
He just gets passed around from relative to relative, and Miss Rachel keeps him every summer."
"Frances, that's not so."
Frances grinned at me. "You're mighty dumb sometimes, Jean Louise. Guess you don't know any better, though."
"What do you mean?"
"If Uncle Atticus lets you run around with stray dogs, that's his business, like Grandma says, so it ain't your fault."
"I guess it ain't your fault if Uncle Atticus is a nigger lover besides, but I'm here to tell you it certainly does mortify the rest of the family."
"Frances, what the hell do you mean?"
"Just what I said. Grandma says it's bad enough he lets you all run wild, but now he's turned out a nigger lover, we'll never be able to walk the streets of Macomb again. He's ruining the family, that's what he's doing."
Frances rose and sprinted down the catwalk to the old kitchen. At a safe distance, he called,
"He's nothing but a nigger lover."
"He is not," I roared.
"I don't know what you're talking about, but you better cut it out this red-hot minute."
I leaped off the steps and ran down the catwalk. It was easy to collar Frances. I said, "Take it back quick." Frances jerked loose and sped into the old kitchen. "Nigger lover," he yelled. When stalking one's prey, it is best to take one's time. Say nothing, and as sure as eggs, he will become curious and emerge. Frances appeared at the kitchen door. "You still mad, Jean Louise?" he asked tentatively.
"Nothing to speak of," I said.
Frances came out on the catwalk.
"You gonna take it back for Ansis?"
But I was too quick on the draw. Frances shot back into the kitchen, so I retired to the steps. I could wait patiently. I had sat there perhaps 5 minutes when I heard Aunt Alexandra speak.
"Where's Frances?"
"He's out yonder in the kitchen."
"He knows he's not supposed to play in there."
Frances came to the door and yelled, "Grandma, she's got me in here and she won't let me out."
"What is all this, Jean Louise?"
I looked up at Aunt Alexandra.
"I haven't got him in there, Auntie. I ain't holding him."
"Yes, she is," shouted Frances. "She won't let me out." "Have you all been fussing?"
"Jean Louise got mad at me, Grandma,"
called Frances. "Frances, come out of there. Jean Louise, if I hear another word out of you, I'll tell your father. Did I hear you say hell a while ago?"
"No'm."
"I thought I did. I better not hear it again." Aunt Alexandra was a back porch listener. The moment she was out of sight, Frances came out, head up and grinning. "Don't you fool with me," he said. He jumped into the yard and kept his distance, kicking tufts of grass, turning around occasionally to smile at me. Jim appeared on the porch, looked at us, and went away. Frances climbed the mimosa tree, came down, put his hands in his pockets, and strolled around the yard.
"Ha,"
he said. I asked him who he thought he was. "Uncle Jack?" Frances said he reckoned I got told for me to just sit there and leave him alone.
"I ain't bothering you," I said.
Frances looked at me carefully, concluded that I had been sufficiently subdued, and crooned softly, "Nigger lover." This time I split my knuckle to the bone on his front teeth. My left impaired, I sailed in with my right, but not for long. Uncle Jack pinned my arms to my sides and said, "Stand still." Aunt Alexandra ministered to Frances, wiping his tears away with her handkerchief, rubbing his hair, patting his cheek. Atticus, Jim, and Uncle Jimmy had come to the back porch when Frances started yelling.
"Who started this?" said Uncle Jack.
Frances and I pointed at each other.
"Grandma," he bawled, "she called me a whore lady and jumped on me."
"Is that true, Scout?" said Uncle Jack.
I reckon so. When Uncle Jack looked down at me, his features were like Aunt Alexandra's.
You know, I told you you'd get in trouble if you used words like that. I told you, didn't I?
Yes, sir, but...
Well, you're in trouble now. Stay there.
I was debating whether to stand there or run, and tarried in indecision a moment too long. I turned to flee, but Uncle Jack was quicker. I found myself suddenly looking at a tiny ant struggling with a breadcrumb in the grass.
"I'll never speak to you again as long as I live. I hate you and despise you and hope you die tomorrow."
A statement that seemed to encourage Uncle Jack more than anything. I ran to Atticus for comfort, but he said I had it coming and it was high time we went home. I climbed into the back seat of the car without saying goodbye to anyone, and at home I ran to my room and slammed the door. Jim tried to say something nice, but I wouldn't let him. When I surveyed the damage, there were only 7 or 8 red marks, and I was reflecting upon relativity when someone knocked on the door. I asked who it was. Uncle Jack answered.
"Go away!"
Uncle Jack said if I talked like that, he'd lick me again, so I was quiet. When he entered the room, I retreated to a corner and turned my back on him. "Scout," he said, "do you still hate me?"
"Go on, please, sir."
"Well, I didn't think you'd hold it against me," he said. "I'm disappointed in you. You had that coming, and you know it."
"Didn't either."
"Honey, you can't go around calling people."
"You ain't fair," I said. "You ain't fair."
Uncle Jack's eyebrows went up. "Not fair? How not?"
"You're real nice, Uncle Jack, and I reckon I love you even after what you did, but you don't understand children much."
Uncle Jack put his hands on his hips and looked down at me. "And why do I not understand children, Miss Jean Louise? Such conduct as yours required little understanding. It was obstreperous, disorderly, and abusive.
You gonna give me a chance to tell you? I don't mean to sass you. I'm just trying to tell you."
Uncle Jack sat down on the bed. His eyebrows came together, and he peered up at me from under them. "Proceed," he said. I took a deep breath.
"Well, in the first place, you never stopped to give me a chance to tell you my side of it. You just lit right into me. When Jim and I fuss, Atticus doesn't ever just listen to Jim's side of it. He hears mine, too. And in the second place, you told me never to use words like that except in extreme provocation. And Francis provocated me enough to knock his block off."
Uncle Jack scratched his head. "What was your side of it, Scout?"
"Francis called Atticus something, and I wasn't about to take it off him."
"What did Francis call him?"
"A nigger lover. I ain't very sure what it means, but the way Francis said it... Tell you one thing right now, Uncle Jack. I swear before God, if I'll sit there and let him say something about Atticus..."
"He called Atticus that?"
"Yes, sir, he did, and a lot more. Said Atticus would be the ruination of the family, and he let Jim and me run wild."
From the look on Uncle Jack's face, I thought I was in for it again. When he said, "We'll see about this," I knew Francis was in for it. "I've got a good mind to go out there tonight.
Please, sir, just let it go. Please."
"I've no intention of letting it go," he said. "Alexandra should know about this. The idea of..." "Wait till I get my hands on that boy."
"Uncle Jack, please promise me something. Please, sir. Promise you won't tell Atticus about this. He asked me one time not to let anything I heard about him make me mad, and I'd rather him think we were fighting about something else instead. Please promise."
"But I don't like Francis getting away with something like that."
"He didn't. You reckon you could tie up my hand? It's still bleeding some."
"Of course I will, baby. I know of no hand I would be more delighted to tie up. Will you come this way?"
Uncle Jack gallantly bowed me to the bathroom. While he cleaned and bandaged my knuckles, he entertained me with a tale about a funny, nearsighted old gentleman who had a cat named Hodge, and who counted all the cracks in the sidewalk when he went to town. "There now," he said, "you'll have a very unladylike scar on your wedding ring finger." "Thank you, sir." "Uncle Jack?"
"Ma'am?"
"What's a whore lady?" Uncle Jack plunged into another long tale about an old prime minister who sat in the House of Commons and blew feathers in the air and tried to keep them there when all about him men were losing their heads. I guess he was trying to answer my question, but he made no sense whatsoever. Later, when I was supposed to be in bed, I went down the hall for a drink of water and heard Atticus and Uncle Jack in the living room. "I shall never marry Atticus."
"Why?"
"I might have children," Atticus said.
"You've a lot to learn, Jack."
"I know. Your daughter gave me my first lesson this afternoon. She said I didn't understand children much and told me why. She was quite right."
"Atticus, she told me how I should have treated her. Oh, dear, I'm so sorry I romped on her."
Atticus chuckled. "She earned it, so don't feel too remorseful." I waited on tenterhooks for Uncle Jack to tell Atticus my side of it, but he didn't. He simply murmured, "Her use of bathroom invective leaves nothing to the imagination. But she doesn't know the meaning of half she says. She asked me what a whore lady was."
"Did you tell her?"
"No, I told her about Lord Melbourne."
"Jack, when a child asks you something, answer him for goodness sake. But don't make a production of it. Children are children. But they can spot an evasion quicker than adults, and evasion simply muddles them."
"No," my father mused, "you had the right answer this afternoon, but the wrong reasons. Bad language is a stage all children go through, and it dies with time when they learn they're not attracting attention with it. Hot-headedness isn't. Scout's got to learn to keep her head and learn soon with what's in store for her these next few months. She's coming along, though. Jim's getting older, and she follows his example a good bit now. All she needs is assistance sometimes."
"Atticus, you've never laid a hand on her."
"I admit that. So far, I've been able to get by with threats."
"Jack, she minds me as well as she can. Doesn't come up to scratch half the time. But she tries."
"That's not the answer," said Uncle Jack.
"No, the answer is she knows I know she tries. That's what makes the difference. What bothers me is that she and Jim will have to absorb some ugly things pretty soon. I'm not worried about Jim keeping his head, but Scout would just as soon jump on someone as look at him if her pride's at stake."
I waited for Uncle Jack to break his promise. He still didn't.
"Atticus, how bad is this going to be? You haven't had too much chance to discuss it."
"It couldn't be worse, Jack. The only thing we've got is a black man's word against the Yules. The evidence boils down to you did, I didn't. The jury couldn't possibly be expected to take Tom Robinson's word against the Yules. Are you acquainted with the Yules?"
Uncle Jack said yes. He remembered them. He described them to Atticus, but Atticus said,
"You're a generation off. The present ones are the same, though."
"What are you going to do, then?"
"Before I'm through, I intend to jar the jury a bit. I think we'll have a reasonable chance on appeal, though. I really can't tell at this stage, Jack. You know, I'd hope to get through life without a case of this kind, but John Taylor pointed at me and said, 'You're it. Let this cup pass from you, eh?'"
"Right.
But do you think I could face my children otherwise? You know what's going to happen as well as I do, Jack. And I hope and pray I can get Jim and Scout through it without bitterness. And most of all, without catching Maycomb's usual disease. Why reasonable people go stark raving mad when anything involving a Negro comes up is something I don't pretend to understand. I just hope that Jim and Scout come to me for their answers instead of listening to the town. I hope they trust me enough. Jean Louise? My scalp jumped. I stuck my head around the corner. Sir? Go to bed. I scurried to my room and went to bed. Uncle Jack was a prince of a fella not to let me down, but I never figured out how Atticus knew I was listening, and it was not until many years later that I realized he wanted me to hear every word he said.